joining me on the Freedom Pact podcast today. I have Annie Jacobson, investigative journalist and best-selling author of such books as Area 51, Phenomena, Operation Paperclip, and now Nuclear War, a Scenario, the brand new book. Annie, welcome to the Freedom Pact podcast. It's an absolute honor to host you.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoy your podcast.
Thank you so much. I want to start this off with a quote that I've seen you reference, and that is, such a war will not last long, and none will ever follow it. There will be no conquerors and no conquests, but only the charred bones of the dead on an uninhabited planet. Now, many people may be listening to that and thinking, it's a very grandiose quote, it's very doom and gloom, it's very extreme, but is that the reality we're at now, where we can't be looking at that as an extreme quote anymore, but a realistic one?
Yes. Well, let's caveat that by, you know, that was written by the late, great William Shire, the fantastic historian who wrote The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And so he was, that quote from him was when thermonuclear weapons were new and were terrifying people. And that terror has since faded. If there's any single purpose of my new book, Nuclear War, a Scenario, it is to demonstrate in appalling detail just how horrifying nuclear war would be. That is not an exaggeration, what Shire said. Here's another quote we can open with, right? And this is attributed to Einstein, although I was not able to source this in any of his archives that I went to, but attributed to him, he was allegedly asked, what weapons will World War III be fought with? And he apparently said, I don't know, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones.
Wow, that's amazing. I love that.
As you know, I end the book, you know, 24,000 years later after nuclear war, and man, civilization, has been undone, and we have returned to hunter-gatherers.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, Einstein suggested.
So as you mentioned there, let's just circle around that. This book is not like any other book on this subject. It is almost a play-by-play of a scenario. You've written a nuclear war scenario and how that would play out in very, very good detail, may I add. Now, for a lot of people that I've spoken to around the subject of nuclear war, friends, family, a lot of people find comfort in just ignorance, ignoring it, not thinking about it, thinking, well, if it's going to happen, I'd rather not know about it. But if you have brought yourself to write about it in such detail, 400 pages, in fact, what was that journey like for you? And how did that play on your psyche and your mindset and your mental health? That must have been quite a hard thing to write about.
Okay, so the first part of the question, like, how did I write this book a scenario? Because yes, it is unlike any of my other six previous books on military and intelligence programs, all of which, by the way, were designed to prevent nuclear World War III. So how many octogenarian sources of mine, whether it's a CIA director or a secretary of defense, said to me, oh, Annie, I spent my life dedicated to making sure nuclear war never happens. And I'm so glad I did that. And that got me thinking, well, what happens if deterrence fails? What happens if these efforts to, air quotes, prevent nuclear war unravel? And so to source the book, it isn't just Annie Jacobson's, you know, edit idea about what might happen. I went to top tier, upper echelon, military and civilian people, presidential advisors, secretary of defenses, the commander of the U.S. nuclear subforces, for example, and put these different questions to them. What would happen at this minute to piece together this scenario predicated on the really early spooky idea that, you know, the Defense Department runs hundreds of these war games annually. Okay. Some are bigger than others. And very few of them have been declassified. One of them, called Proud Prophet, which I reference in the book, was declassified. And the shocking part about it was that no matter how nuclear war starts, it ends in apocalyptic-like Armageddon. That is shocking. The second part of your question, well, how did I sleep at night? You know, as a reporter, I have spent my professional life interviewing people who have put themselves absolutely in the line of fire, right? And the reason they're talking to me is they're still alive. Many of their colleagues are died in these battles and operations that I've written about. That's scary to me. That keeps me up at night because in those interviews, because I love working with sources over long periods of time, right? I've gotten to know them and I've gotten to know the inner workings of their mind and their hearts. And that upsets them that all their friends died and they're still here. This is a hypothetical situation we're all trying to avoid. To give you the facts, the Defense Department facts of what it's like to have third or fourth degree burns, okay, and have to have your limbs amputated. And I try to do it, you know, sort of as necessary. That is meant to make people want to have a conversation as you and I are having now.
Yeah. And on that journey, through the times where this book may have felt, you know, a little bit of a burden to you to carry on your shoulders to write and think about in such depth, what were the hardest thoughts to think? Was it the effect this would have on the world, the effect this would have on you, or the effect it would have on your loved ones?
I think the most shocking fundamental of all of it is the kind of Orwellian concept that this actually exists and is totally real and literally could happen tomorrow or later today. And that's an actual quote by a former STRATCOM commander. Okay. Those are the individual, that's the individual who gives the launch order to the 150,000 people below him after he gets it from the president. Right. So the idea that we're all walking around, it's kind of the ultimate whistling past the graveyard, right? That, I mean, I'm going to give you a hard-hitting statistic, right? Not to annoy listeners with numbers, but to just wrap your head around this thought, right? When people learn that nuclear weapons get deployed in seconds and minutes, not hours, okay? There's no like planning around the table. There's no going to Congress and like, hey, what do you guys think about this? It's like now. Okay. And so what are those weapons that are going to be launched in seconds and minutes? The number I want you to consider is that America right now in this moment has presently ready for launch 1,770 deployed nuclear weapons.
Wow.
Repeating 1,707. Okay. Russia has 1,674. And we know those numbers precisely thanks to the team at the Federation of American Scientists who keeps track of them. And of course they change, you know, here and there every year. But those are the deployed nuclear weapons. There are thousands more on reserve in case we needed them for later. But as you learn in my scenario, you don't really need the later ones because everyone's dead. And again, that was a direct quote from Obama's FEMA director, Craig Fugate. You asked me about, you know, doing these interviews. I was, a little bit timid at first, like asking these bold questions, like what would happen after a nuclear war? What would FEMA do? FEMA being the Federal Emergency Management Agency here in the United States. They're responsible for hurricanes, for floods, you know, for earthquakes, for catastrophes, for taking care of people afterwards. It's called population protection planning. And Craig Fugate said to me, Andy, keep in mind, we plan for asteroids, okay? We plan for low probability, high consequence events. And he said, the direct quotes are, of course, in the book. I'm paraphrasing. After a nuclear war, there's nothing we can do because everyone will be dead. Direct quote.
There's a chapter in the book you mentioned there about how quickly these things move. There's a chapter in the book called The First 24 Minutes, and this chapter genuinely left me speechless. If you could portray the people right now who haven't read the book yet, I'm sure they will, just how alert and how quickly are the US government to react to a nuclear attack? Because you broke this down in the book second by second, and to even think that you can break it down second by second is just mind-boggling to me.
Well, thank you for noticing that. And again, part of the reporting process when I realized this was like, wait a minute, why has no one ever broken this down second by second in narrative form? Right? Because I write narrative nonfiction. So I'm not giving you my opinion. I'm not giving you a bunch of statistics. I'm not giving you analysis about how the war might happen. China does this, Russia, none of that. It's just, here is what happens starting in the first fraction of a second. Right. And this all comes from the policy called launch on warning. Right. America has a policy called launch on warning. It's exactly as it sounds. Said differently, it means that when the Defense Department learns a nuclear missile is on the way to the United States from an enemy country or enemy rogue state, it could be, then the Defense Department moves into the second by second protocols to launch on warning. The president gets advised right around minute 4 or 5. We do not wait to absorb the blow, right? We don't wait to, like, let's wait and see how many people die in that nuclear strike. That's not what policy says in the United States. It says we launch on warning. And so the first warning is the first fraction of a second. I write about the remarkably advanced satellite systems that the Defense Department has in space, built by Lockheed. It's called SBIRS, the space-based infrared system of satellites. They can detect the launch, the hot rocket exhaust on the launch of a nuclear missile in under 1 second. And it begins from there.
The book, it stresses the urgency of this matter. Now, you've touched on this already. You said that you've used that quote, the scenario could happen tomorrow, or it could happen later today. It could happen as soon as we get off this podcast, or even whilst we're on this podcast. Just, I think for many people, especially when recent wars have happened and the conversations around nuclear war were trending on Twitter, a lot of people, like I said earlier, either choose to ignore it or they think to themselves, well, I'm safe right now. This is, you know, a scary problem, but it's down the line. Just how sudden could it happen? As we mentioned there, it could happen later today. And are we living through the warning right now for a potential nuclear war?
All valid and significant questions. And they all sort of have yeses and they all sort of have like caveats. Okay, so right. Yes, the saber rattling is as terrifying as it's ever been. You have Vladimir Putin saying that he has not taken nuclear weapons off the table, not taken weapons of mass destruction off the table. That is horrifying. North Korea recently accused the United States of trying to incite a nuclear war on the peninsula. That is terrifying. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that, you know, we're all one misstep, one misunderstanding away from a nuclear annihilation, okay? So the threat is there, but in fact, it has always been there. Is it more right now? Is it less? Well, if nuclear war were to begin, we are not going to be having that debate. The reason why I wrote the book and believe it's important to have this conversation goes back to, okay, what actually could be done? And while it's not my job, and I would never try to make it my job to like spearhead, you know, action. I'm not an activist. I'm a journalist. But I remember very clearly being in high school and seeing in 1983 a television show called The Day After. And it showed in graphic detail what would happen were a nuclear war to take place between the United States and the Soviet Union. You're too young, right? But anyone of my generation saw it. And many people read my book and say, oh my God, I had the same feeling that I had when I watched that horrific TV show. Well, what happened after the TV show? We know from President Reagan's memoirs, he was deeply depressed. Literally, he wrote that. So what did he do? He picked up the phone and called Gorbachev. And 2 years later, they met at Reykjavik and they had a arms reduction treaty, which significantly lowered the weapons, significantly lowered the threat, and thereby brought everybody's attention to this issue, which is, oh my God, we cannot have a nuclear war. We can't even, people cannot even be talking about such a thing. And I believe that in the decades since, that people have been mesmerized into thinking that threat wasn't real, including some of my octogenarian sources back, 10 years ago when this threat was not what it is now. But there are 9 nuclear armed nations on the planet, not just 2 anymore.
If you don't mind me asking, if you can recount, what are those 9?
So there's US and Russia. And then there's China. China has about 500 weapons, right? And the recent prediction by the Defense Department is that in 10 years, they will have 1,500. They are building nuclear weapons. Then there's India and Pakistan. Then there is the UK and France. Then there is Israel. And then there is North Korea. Yeah. That makes 9. Some of those countries are in direct conflict with one another.
Yeah. There was a lot of ridicule for many years around the prepper community, those who prepare for disaster, nuclear fallout, etc., building survival kits and bunkers and whatnot. There's actually a pretty good book written by Dr. Bradley Garrett, who investigates the psychology of preppers. Do you think that the general consensus around preppers is changing now with the climate we're in and they're not as laughed about or ridiculed as they once were?
Two thoughts on preppers. Okay. The first is like the ultimate prepper, which is the U.S. government's preparation for nuclear war for its continuity of government program, which is called COG, right? Mm. And then the second part I want to address is what Carl Sagan said about that, right? Okay. So actually, I'm going to say that first. I wrote the book basically in 3 acts. You mentioned the first one, 24 minutes, right? Then the second one is the next 24 minutes. And the last one is the last 24 minutes, because this all ends in 72 minutes. Yeah. Okay. And then I have a kind of coda chapter, a denouement, whereby we flash into nuclear winter. And that happens immediately in the aftermath when the bombs stop dropping and runs for about 10 years. And then I flash forward to 24,000 years in the future and use some archaeological insights. That was inspired by the words of Carl Sagan, who, when he wrote a book with some colleagues back when the nuclear winter theory first came to be in the early 1980s, the book was called The Cold and the Dark. And it's kind of the foundational piece of my denouement, because in it, Sagan warns that, this world after nuclear winter, the only survivors will be those with hunter-gatherer, extreme preppers, and those with hunter-gatherer-like skills. And then you have to ask yourself, do you want to even live in that world? Riddled with disease and no civilization back like the world was 15,000 years ago. Are preppers, in the right or the wrong? Well, okay. Or rather, what do I think about them? The government has a prepper program, and it has since World War II, since the invention of the atomic bomb. And now, of course, thermonuclear bombs are an order of magnitude more powerful that we can't even begin to, imagine the scope. I describe it in detail in the book. the main bunker for the Pentagon. It's actually the alternate Pentagon command site. It's known colloquially as Raven Rock or Site R. Its official title is the Alternate National Military Command Center. And that is the bunker underneath the Pentagon. And it will, in the event of nuclear war, that all things Pentagon move to Raven's Rock, which is about 70 miles outside of the White House. The president gets there by helicopter. Those are the protocols. In my scenario, I have the Secretary of Defense going there by helicopter, escaping the Pentagon. The Pentagon's a target. And that is sourced from my conversations with a former U.S. Secretary of Defense who told me that that's what he would do. Why? Because the plan is that the United States government must continue, you know, and again, must, in air quotes, must continue after nuclear strikes. And so who's the ultimate prepper? The government. So yeah. If you want to make fun of preppers, you're kind of making fun of the government.
Amazing. On this subject of preparing then, now I know a lot of people, well, a lot of friends of mine, when they get on a plane, they don't really like listening to the cabin crew's advice for what happens in the event of a plane crash, because it's quite scary to think about, oh, this is something I might actually need to know. In the case of advice for the citizens in case of a nuclear attack, what is the messaging sent out by the US government to its population on how best to act in an event that there was a nuclear attack on the United States of America?
And that was one of the most shocking things I learned from FEMA Director Craig Fugate himself, which was this: hope that you have Pedialyte. Don't forget your morals. Do you guys have Pedialyte over there in the UK?
We don't.
Okay. It's basically like a drink that you give babies when they have diarrhea.
Because
it replaces electrolytes.
Yeah, we have a version. It's called Calpol. Okay.
That's the advice. That's from the man himself who was in charge of FEMA for almost the entire Obama administration. And again, he's not cowboying this. This is the reality of what is called a bolt out of the blue attack, okay? Mm. And a bolt out of the blue attack is when it's an unwarned nuclear attack against the United States. Unwarned meaning all of a sudden the SBIRS satellite system sees a ballistic missile has launched. And within seconds, all of the entire U.S. National Security Command and Control system of systems that is tracking that ballistic missile in seconds, one by one by one. After about 180 seconds or so, they can determine the trajectory of the ballistic missile. For example, I went through all of this, you know, with the engineers who work on these problems, right? Like, okay, after such and such seconds, if something launched out of Pyongyang, North Korea, which is how I begin the bolt out of the blue attack scenario in nuclear war scenario, that we can track it for seconds, and you know, oh, wait, is it going to go to Moscow? No. Is it going to go to the United States? Okay, is it going to Hawaii? Seconds pass. No, wait, United States? Okay, you see, seconds. And then that information is all being fed from the satellite system down to the Space Force, to the Aerospace Data Facility in Colorado. And from there, it goes out to the three command centers I tell you about. Three nuclear bunkers in the United States that become the focus of these first 24 minutes. The one under the Pentagon that we spoke about, the National Military Command Center. And there's one in Cheyenne Mountain, which is very legendary and has appeared in the movies. It's a real complex. And then there is one that is not written about a lot, which is the bunker beneath STRATCOM, U.S. Strategic Command. And that is in Nebraska. And that is specifically in Nebraska, because originally, before the invention of the ballistic missile, the fear was that Soviet bombers would, you know, overtake the United States. And if you had your central command bunker in Nebraska, in the middle of the United States, it gave you a little more lead time to duck and cover, because the radars could pick up the aircraft as they came in from the East Coast.
The one thing I'd love to ask you about, and this is again something I've picked up on mostly because of the area I live in. I live in South Wales, so quite far away from central London, quite far away from anything that would probably be considered a target in the UK. We're probably the forgotten country of the UK. Not many, you'd be surprised how many people don't know this country exists. So for a lot of people here, a lot of the talk has always been around things like this and world wars and nuclear wars, is that we're so far away from any relevant place that would be attacked that we almost don't have to worry as much. But is it wrong to think like that? And to what extent can this affect everyone, not just those people who live in the Londons of the world and the Washingtons of the world?
To report the concept of nuclear winter and to be able to answer the question like you just asked me, I interviewed at length Professor Brian Toon, who was one of the first, he was one of the five original authors of the nuclear winter theory, which first published in the early 80s. Toon's professor was Carl Sagan, another one of the five authors. And Brian explained to me, about how nuclear winter theory was received in the 80s. The Defense Department said, oh my God, this is Soviet propaganda, and how it's gone through different iterations of people paying attention to it over the decades. And where we are now with the climate modeling systems we have, in fact, what Toon and his colleagues presented in the original nuclear winter theory is now proven to be even worse. The nuclear winter will last 10 years, not just one. He explained to me that the agricultural belt, the mid-lateral zones of the earth, so for example, from places like Iowa and Ukraine, the breadbaskets of the world, these will be frozen over for years. The bodies of water there will be under thick sheets of ice. So you in Wales will. You'll be frozen over. The Arctic Ocean will expand by 50%, the ice. Maybe what Toon said to me was that their climate modeling shows that people in New Zealand and Australia might survive for two reasons, because they won't freeze over, in essence. They won't be hit by so much radiation, and they will be able to have some kind of an agricultural system spring back up from the land.
The level of responsibility that comes with having ownership over a nuclear button. Now, let's say when a president in America is elected, and you've got Donald Trump or Joe Biden, to what extent is there training in place for having nuclear responsibility? Is there a sort of standardized procedure that, these leaders go through to really understand the level of responsibility that comes with that button?
Every incoming president gets a pre-presidential briefing where they learn about nuclear weapons. But I quote a Secretary of Defense in the book telling me that, that's not what the president is concerned with when they step into office. Now, the most impactful interviews on that subject were ones I did with Leon Panetta. He was America's Secretary of Defense. Before that, he was America's director of the CIA. And before that, he was President Clinton's White House chief of staff. And so his experience in those three major roles really gave me an ability to comprehend the answer to your question, because he himself was shocked that he was explaining to me that as CIA director, he didn't need to know, in air quotes, about the nuclear triad. He knew about it theoretically, but he didn't know about it, the tactile physical realities of it. But boy, when he became Secretary of Defense, he was suddenly off touring the missile silos, examining the submarines, looking at the bombers, under because he would be the person that the president would turn to and say, give me advice, right? But he also said that when he was White House chief of staff, he barely could be bothered, my words, not his, with, this nuclear war briefing, because the president had so much on his plate, tragically to my eye, mostly political, mostly scandalous, So you have a president who is the sole authority sole launch authority on nuclear weapons, meaning the president asked permission of no one to launch nuclear weapons, not the SECDEF, not the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, not the Congress. He has the football with him 24/7, 365 days a year. It's outside his bedroom. I interviewed Secret Service agents about this. He has that authority. And yet, the president of the United States, we can see it now, is just overwhelmingly absorbed with issues that affect really only him and his immediate circle, not the billions of people on the planet. And if there's anything out of this book that I could point toward, maybe a wink and a nod, it would be like, why is the president so concerned with his own self?
Hearing you talk about that, this idea, you always hear it, the nuclear button, the click of the button. What does the reality of that look like? And I remember when the first rumbling started of maybe Vladimir Putin using the nuclear button, and people were saying that, you know, that they didn't think that those orders would be followed, or that people wouldn't, you know, would think twice in his staff about actually executing that. When what is the reality like, say, in regards to the United States of America? If that command is given, is there 100% likelihood that that is going to be actioned?
In 2022, Vladimir Putin made a statement for the first time ever answering your exact question, which essentially said, yes, we have a launch on warning policy too. Before that, there had been debate among the sort of experts in the Russian military system, their command and control, many of whom argued that Russia had to absorb the blow first policy. Okay, but that all changed in 2022 when Putin said, when we get strategic, you know, warning, we will launch. So that the United States and Russia are right now in this standoff of, you know, literally what is called hair trigger alert. Yeah. But let me tell you, I'm going to tell you something interesting, if I may, about the football, right? Because Los Alamos, the laboratory here where the nuclear weapons are made, was very forthcoming with me when I was reporting this book. They were extremely helpful with documents, photographs, information, answering questions. And I believe that was a significant shift because, of course, I've written about nuclear weapons in all my books from an analytical, you know, from a different side, sort of an action point of view. But they were very forthcoming, and I believe that has to do with the impact that the movie Oppenheimer has had on culture, on the world, in an extremely positive way if you're a journalist looking in, because suddenly the lab felt far less defensive and far more transparent than they had previously been, which I believe as a journalist is exactly what a democracy needs, because you want people to be informed. We can all make a decision. People can read this book and then decide for themselves how they want to think about that in their own life. If there is any action for them to take, how they want to vote, if they want to write to their congressman. I mean, the list goes on. At one point, we had 60,000 nuclear weapons in the world. The people got those reduced. You know, people going out and having giant marches against nuclear war, against nuclear weapons in the 80s. But Los Alamos declassified for this book documents about the origin story of the football, which I found fascinating. And I write about them in the book, but when you are a journalist and you suddenly get access to something that's completely unknown, earlier pieces of the puzzle begin to make sense. Yeah. And that is a kind of transparency. It's a legacy transparency that becomes really important. And then journalists after me will, you know, take what I have written and be able to pull on a tiny thread that really interests them and expand that narrative and expand understandings about certain things. And I was able to do that with the football and then therefore with the Russian version of the football, which is called the Sheget, which follows around Putin and at least two of his military commanders, 24/7, 365, able to launch a nuclear war on sole authority.
That's incredible. And just a testament to, you know, the work that's gone into this book. I was reading the list of the interviews you conducted and the citations, and it's so detailed, and I was dreading thinking the amount of work and preparation and time that you must have spent on this book. So I do really, really want to commend you for that. Before we start to wind down, I just on the topic, circling back to responsibility. A few weeks ago, I went to see Professor Brian Cox live, and he was giving a lecture. And he ended the lecture by talking about the responsibility of world leaders in the context of an astrophysicist. And that he said that without life, the universe, by very definition, is meaningless. It's clearly that meaning enters the universe with consciousness, and consciousness is obviously the property of living things. And so without living things, there's no meaning in the universe. So if this is the only planet in the galaxy that hosts intelligent civilization, which the Fermi paradox would suggest, then it's essentially the only island of meaning in a sea of 400 billion stars. And therefore, there's a tremendous responsibility to protect the island of meaning. So if we mess this up, then we're not just destroying this world, we'd be responsible for annihilating meaning forever in a galaxy. Do you share that view? And do you think that that ever crosses the mind of the people who hold this responsibility to that extent?
Well, that is brilliantly said. And I 1000% agree. It reminds me of the idea that 66 million years ago, an asteroid slammed into Earth and killed 70% of life, including all the dinosaurs. And as we know now, from me having reported and you having read the book, the only other event besides an asteroid strike that could kill that much life, and maybe all life, is a nuclear war. So the difference between the asteroid strike and nuclear war, as you pointed to, is humans. Our consciousness, our brilliance, our ability to create and make tools, you know, starting with turning stones into arrowheads and sticks into spears, is how we began as a civilization. And imagine how we can evolve. Right. But the evolution could absolutely stop with a nuclear war. So you and I are of two minds. Now, with that said, it appears this increasing trend, or maybe it's always been there, for our leaders, but now leaders who are in charge of that, you know, the button, as you quoted Shire in the beginning, they are decreasingly interested in this idea of, you know, the lofty ideals that you referred to about consciousness, about responsibility, about imagination, about creativity, about advancement, and far more interested in, you know, having a big conflict with someone and winning. Mm-hmm. And there is no winning in nuclear war.
The final question that I end every interview with, regardless of the guest or topic, and this is quite a prevalent question given the severity of the subject we're talking about. And especially for you, who's put themselves in this scenario directly and probably had many thoughts about what that looks like and means for you. My question is, for Annie Jacobson right now, what makes life worth living?
Always great question. You know, when you get stumped, you know, it's a really, really significant question. There is no easy, simple answer.
Yeah.
But of course, it's the joyful day to day. You know, I have like a deeply awesome family and personal life, right? And so that's the joy I get. And the professional lane is extraordinarily challenging in the best possible way, because I like writing about enigmas. I like writing about paradoxes. I like writing about things that aren't easily understandable or solvable because you put your brain to it, you know, you put your consciousness to it, whatever mystery that may be. And you lean into the mystery of where that might go, both as yourself and also with the new friends you make along the way.
Beautifully, beautifully put. Well, Annie, thank you so much for joining me today. As I mentioned earlier, it's been an absolute goal of mine to host you on this show. I'm not just saying this because you're with me today, but you are genuinely one of my favorite authors. I think the detail of the work you do is absolutely fantastic and just a testament to your talents. For anyone out there now who listen to this conversation and thinks, I want to read this piece of work for myself, where's the best place we can point them to check it out and connect with you and your other work?
So my book, Nuclear War, A Scenario, is pretty much sold everywhere where books are sold. And I also have an amazing publisher in the UK, Transworld Penguin Random House. So everywhere where books are sold. And thank you so much for having me.
I will make sure all that is linked in the description below. Yeah, once again, thank you so much.